From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. The authors of the 2011 Academically Adrift Report release a new book this week that says many students remain adrift after graduation. And Goucher College tells prospective students that as an alternative to test scores, transcripts, and admission essays, they can submit two high school class papers and a two-minute video for their college application. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation today, please note that you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our first segment today, we're going to talk about Aspiring Adults Adrift. Aspiring Adults Adrift, the new book by the authors of the controversial 2011 title Academically Adrift, follows more than 1,000 students who were freshmen at four-year colleges into the job market of the, quote, worst recession since the Great Depression, end quote. The authors report that undergraduates, quote, are drifting through college with no sense of purpose. Additionally, more than a third of these students showed no significant gains in learning as a result of their 4 years of college. Not surprisingly, many were working at low-skilled service jobs unrelated to their college majors and experience. Many were also back at home, living with their parents after graduation. Yet despite the economic upheaval that has played havoc with their initial job opportunities and early career aspirations, many of these students remain nonetheless optimistic about better opportunities ahead. Joining us for this conversation are Josipa Rocha, the Associate Professor of Sociology and Education at the University of Virginia and a co-author of the Aspiring Adults Adrift Report, and Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Josipa, let me start with you. I think many of us look at this report. There's a lot of fascinating data and a lot of interesting statements. But I think one of the questions that emerges very quickly is, what's different now? I mean, the reality is if they happen to have graduated into a down economy, whether it's 2010 through 13, whether it was at the beginning of this decade in the 1990s and the 1980s and the 1970s, it seems that large number of recent college graduates are, unfortunately, always adrift. They're often back living with their parents and often working at low-wage service jobs, at least for the first year or two out of college. What makes the circumstances of the cohort that's the focus of your work, students who graduated during the downturn that began with the crash of 2008, so different?
What I'd like to point out is that the aspiring adult cohort did enter the labor market, and it is a very difficult time. But it is a mistake to attribute the difficulties in the transitions to adulthood to these recent economic challenges, right? A number of the trends that we have been observing over time, as you pointed out, have been there before the recession and will be there after the recession. So the proportion of students who live at home and how much they depend on their parents financially has been increasing over time. The civic participation and engagement has been going down. And so, you know, this is not simply a reflection of the recession and the hope that everything's going to get better afterwards. And what really the question is not what is kind of different, but the question is what roles do colleges and universities play in preparing students for transitions after college?
So, Scott, you followed labor markets and the experience of college graduation for several decades. As I recall, you probably entered the labor market in the mid-1980s when it was a down market. Does that assessment make sense, that there is something different about this moment, this zeitgeist, that you just can't write it off to say this is just part of the unfortunate experience during a down economy?
I think there is something different. It's certainly true that those who were sort of unfortunate enough to launch their post-college careers in a recession have always had a more difficult time than those who launch in better times. But one, you have a longer period of recession here, or economic downturn, or whatever you want to call it. This is not a two-year period. Arguably, we're still in something that started in 2008. You often have students graduating with much more debt. And what struck me very much in the book was not that students were having to move home desperately, but that many seem to sort of be accepting it and accepting it potentially for the long term. So you've got people with debt not starting careers, not starting families, or settling into new communities, seemingly disengaged and yet happy. That struck me as different from what I recall before.
Well, let's talk then about the relationship between these students and their parents, because this is a cohort that many on campus say have come of age with helicopter parents, that perhaps unlike cohorts a decade or two or three ago are in constant contact with their parents via email and cell phone conversations, not once a week, but perhaps two or three times a week. Does that helicopter parent role, Josipa, play a role in some of this as well?
But helicopter parents are very class-related, right? So helicopter parents is largely a middle-class and upper-middle-class phenomenon, and not necessarily a phenomenon for all the students in higher education. Students growing up today are entering kind of new ideas about what adulthood means, and perhaps parents and students are reframing what it means to be independent. Indeed, students often talk about independence in more psychological terms. At the same time that they do that, however, they say that financial independence from parents is one of the crucial aspects of being an adult. And so, you know, there is perhaps more connection, there's more involvement of parents, in particularly middle-class, upper-middle-class parents, in students' lives in college. But at the same time, you know, I'm not sure that those parents were looking forward to hoping or expecting that their children in these numbers would come home after college.
Okay. But let's turn to your comments and to the critique that the book offers about institutions. Effectively, you say that effectively institutions are divesting in faculty while investing in amenities. The book takes campus officials to task for emphasizing comfortable amenities over rigorous academics. Many campuses are building climbing walls in the gym, yet most students self-report that their courses required minimal reading and writing assignments. Absent the climbing walls, I mean, the other question is, are things so different than they were a decade or two ago? Is academic rigor really the remedy for being adrift?
Things are different today. If you look at available data on, for example, how much students spend studying, economists Babcock and Marx have shown that, you know, in the early 20th century until about 1960s, students spend on average 25 hours a week studying and then about 15 hours in class. The amount of time they spend studying has dropped in half through today. So today, students spend on average only about 12 hours a week studying. Their grades haven't suffered as a consequence of that. Actually, the grades have gone up over time. And in our study, even those who study very little, even those who study less than 5 hours a week alone, still, you know, get a 3.2 GPA. So that's what's different. What's also different is how schools are investing their resources. So if we track expenditures over time, we see that the proportion of resources dedicated to student services has gone up, and so the professionals that are focused on student service areas has gone up. We've also increased reliance on part-time faculty. The livelihood of part-time faculty really depends heavily on generating enrollment and getting good student evaluations, which provides the wrong incentives in terms of academic rigor. And so a number of things are different today and have changed over time in ways that support the consumer attitude of students and decrease the academic rigor on our college campuses.
I want to come back to the issue that seems to be a constant refrain as I read the book about students who spend 5 hours a week or more studying alone.
Right.
I mean, there's a good body of research by Yuri Treisman and others about the value and impact of study groups, particularly for low-income and minority students. Is it the case that students, you know, that time studying alone has been replaced by time studying in groups, whether they're lower division undergraduates or upper division students?
Well, I think it depends what we mean by studying in groups, right? So our research in Academically Adrift showed that our studying alone was related to growth in critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing, while studying in groups was not. But I think the big question there is, you know, lots of the research on studying in groups is talking about very structured environments, very structured group work in which faculty have been trained and implement groups with very purposeful and intentional goals in mind. Oftentimes it's in the sciences, right, where there's a problem to solve and teams are designed to solve problems. So those are very different contexts and environments for group studying than what often happens, which is that the faculty simply ask students to go work on a group project with relatively little, if any, guidance, because faculty themselves have had very little training in structuring groups and group work, and students have had very little experience in how to make groups work effectively. And so they go out and, you know, whether the group studying turns into socializing or whether one person ends up doing the task while the rest, you know, contribute maybe a little, right? So it's not a matter of saying that group studying is bad. We were drawing attention to really thinking carefully what that means and whether you can simply say to students to go work in groups and study and whether that's productive at all.
Scott, many presidents that you deal with on a regular basis, I suspect, bristle at the statement of underinvesting in faculty while investing in amenities, although I suspect at many campuses faculty might agree. What do you see as the response to that statement?
Some of them may bristle. Many others are boasting about their amenities. As relates to some of the themes in this new book, many colleges are boasting about what they're doing to help students launch their careers. Now, whether it's the right thing, they're doing the right things or not, I think remains to be seen. Whether it will have an impact during the recession remains to be seen. But as relates to academic work, a lot of surveys of employers show employers worry about the professional skills that students bring. Are students, are new graduates prepared to show up on time every day, to take direction, to do tasks that they might not enjoy along with other tasks that they might enjoy more? So a lot of the criticism of employers, of new employees, actually I think relates in an interesting way to the themes of this book.
But I think, Scott, as I think about the landscape on college campuses, both small institutions and large, elite, and less selective, you know, at one level, campuses have made significant investment in services that weren't there. If you look at the proportion of students who take internships, do have other kinds of experiences as a way of enhancing or, if you will, padding their portfolio, much higher than a decade and certainly two or three decades ago. And concurrent with that, a whole range of external service providers, many of them web-based, trying to help students with those skills as well. Websites that again, become conduits to internships and other kinds of experiences.
All that's true, and yet the question is, do students need a list of internships, or do they need to be prepared to do well in those internships? Are students prepared to work longer hours than they might like? And actually, as interns and new grads, are they willing to do that? Do they have the wherewithal to do that? You know, part of the adjustment post-college life is, you know, not necessarily getting everything you want. And at institutions that are competing heavily for students, there has certainly been a big emphasis on the quality of student life, on helping students. Now, one could say that new employers should be better about mentoring, but the reality is many of them aren't. And so many of them are looking for new graduates who will be self-starters and not necessarily finding them.
So, Yosef, let me pick up on Scott's point. Two issues. One, the issue of students getting what they want. You know, are the adrift young adults, in one sense, victims of their own inflated expectations of self-worth? But two, what we've also noticed in the economy over the past two decades, again to Scott's point, the expectation that more students and more entry-level jobs will hit the ground running, that in many industries the kind of training programs that used to be very much part of the landscape at mid-size and large firms have vanished. How does that play into the issue of being adrift in the entry to the labor market?
It plays into thinking carefully what institutions need to do to prepare students for that transition, because students may not have those opportunities later, and employers expect them to enter the labor market ready. And again, not just with the skills, which we have argued are really important, but also with the attitudes and dispositions needed in a new labor market. I mean, what students have learned in higher education today is that success is easy to attain, right? If you can study, you know, I'm going to go back to that, but if you can study fewer than five or fewer hours a week alone and still get a 3.2 GPA, the message that that conveys is that it's very easy to be successful. It doesn't take a lot of effort. It doesn't take, you know, anything special. You can do it quite easily. And what is that really helping students and preparing them for the job market and for the employment opportunities ahead, where success may not be that easy to come by and may require extra work, extra attention, and much more effort than they may be expecting? So we're doing a disservice not just by not teaching them skills and developing their critical thinking, complex reasoning, writing skills, but also by not helping to foster development of attitudes and dispositions that would facilitate that transition to the labor market.
I want to turn to the external audience. I think it's fair to say that the new book, or more likely the very short summary or sound bites that members of various state legislatures will read, will fuel even more critiques about the failure of colleges, particularly public institutions, to prepare students for the, quote, high-skilled, high-paying jobs that governors and members of the state legislatures seek, and that critique is often a very thinly veiled critique of liberal arts programs. Yet you note throughout the book that students in some professional programs in business were clearly adrift, even though in theory those programs should have given them very specific skills, and also that students who came from the liberal arts in many ways were less adrift than some of their peers. What do I do with those two or three different messages, you know, if I'm off campus in a legislature and perhaps I'm actually reading the full book, or if I'm on campus and I want to respond to the critique that I'm hearing from the legislature?
You know, simply focusing on the professional field and business here in particular and neglecting liberal arts is both short-sighted and a misreading of the book. So, yes, there is that one place where college major is related to early labor market outcomes. So business majors do have higher earnings than some of the liberal arts fields. However, that is not the case if we think about labor market outcomes more broadly. So if we consider other outcomes in the labor market, there are no differences between the business majors and the kind of traditional arts and science core. So there's no difference in whether students lose their jobs. There's no difference in whether they find skilled employment. And so, you know, focusing on these early labor market outcomes, focusing simply on earnings, which are very unstable and change a lot as students change jobs, as well as just volatility of early transitions, is completely short-sighted, because it doesn't pay attention, A, that earnings are not the only outcome, that there are other outcomes in a labor market as well as outside of the labor market, like the civic engagement, and B, it fails to consider the long-term trajectory. So business majors might get that first job in part because business schools tend to spend a lot of time on internships and apprenticeships and linking students to the job market. But what's going to happen over time remains to be seen. And some research suggests that liberal arts majors indeed catch up to the professional majors over time.
Scott, will the sound bites that wind up on the desks of members of state legislatures across the country just fuel the criticism that we've seen over the last several years?
Oh, I think so. I think they're already there, and certainly they will use that. But I'm not sure that we want to punish the authors of this book for how others may use it. I think, to answer your original question, Casey, about what should college presidents do if the sound bite comes out that way, I think the evidence is overwhelming that those with college degrees are better off than those without. And I don't see anything in this book contradicting that claim. In this terrible recessionary period that we've been in, those with more education have fared better than those without education. They just haven't fared as well as people would think or would hope for a college graduate. And this has all happened at the time of rising student debt, so there is more pressure to get a good job and be able to start repaying those loans. The data, though, don't really raise questions about the value of going to college. The book points out how hard it is starting out right now and raises questions about whether colleges are adequately preparing students.
Yosef, I want to hand you a magic wand, and for the moment, I want to make you a college president. So based on your work, based on what you know, if you're a college president, or you're talking to a college president who says, okay, I agree with this, I see this on my campus, I see this in the landscape, what are the three things I can do now to make an effective change to turn the tide? What are those three things I do?
Yeah, I don't think we need a magic wand. I think we need courage and we need collective action. The message itself in terms of what to do is quite simple, which is we need to increase academic rigor. Kind of three things you could do right away the current world that we live in. One is to expect rigorous instruction and reward faculty for it. That's oftentimes not the case today because faculty are either not evaluated on their instruction or in ways that are counterproductive. Two, you can work on providing a counter-narrative. From the moment students set foot on campus, there should be an emphasis on academic rigor. It should be everywhere. It should be on campus tours, in orientations, in freshman welcome events, in extracurricular activities. It should permeate the campus from the moment students step on through their 4 years there. They can, of course, have a good time, but college has more to offer than that. And that counter-narrative has not really been presented and has not been a part of college campuses. And third, I think you need to assess subject-specific skills as well as general collegiate skills, such as critical thinking, and learn where on your campus students are doing well, where they're developing those skills, support those endeavors, and figure out how to address areas in which students are lagging.
Josipa and Scott, thank you very much. I wish we had more time, but this has been a very engaging and a very quick and a very informative conversation about a very important work, a very important book. Thank you both. For our second conversation today, we're going to talk about transcript-free admissions applications. This week, Goucher College in Maryland, a women's liberal arts institution that went co-ed in the early 1990s, announced a new, quote, transcript-free admissions application policy. In lieu of the traditional documentation such as high school transcripts, test scores, admissions essays, and letters of recommendation, as of this fall, Goucher applicants can opt to submit a 2-minute video plus copies of two papers they wrote for high school classes in a signed statement of academic integrity. Goucher President Jose Antonio Bowen, who joins us today, who assumed the Goucher presidency in July, hopes that the video application alternative will convince prospective students that, according to the refrain heard throughout the YouTube video that the college posted about the new admissions option, prospective students will know that they are, quote, more than a number to Goucher. And I'm pleased to welcome Jose Antonio Bowen, president of Goucher College, and with us still is Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. My thanks to you both. Jose, let me turn to you. Tell us about the how. You got to campus in July, according to the public documents. This announcement about the new video app came roughly 2 months, 60 days later. Was this in the works prior to your arrival? Is this something that you initiated after the announcement of your presidency? Tell us a bit about the backstory that got to the announcement yesterday.
Sure. Thanks. So, yeah, no, I arrived in the office on July 1st, in the first couple of weeks, we started talking about admissions and admissions policies, you know, the usual review of what goes on campus. Goucher has a long history of innovation. Goucher was an early school to go test optional. Goucher was the first school to require all students to study abroad. And so we were asking some questions. And so it wasn't in the works previously. But what has been in the works for a long time is that the college application system is largely broken. It misses talent in two key ways. The first is called undermatching, and this has been well documented by Carolyn Hawksby at Stanford and others, that a large proportion of high-achieving but low-income students don't apply to any selective liberal arts colleges. So these are students who actually could get into Harvard or Stanford. They might even be a valedictorian, but they're poor, and they're first generation. They don't know about colleges. So they often go to community college, or they don't go to any college. So we are missing potential in the country there. Stanford's solution was, you know, to send people more information. If they had more information, they'd make better choices. And that's a good solution, I think. But we wanted to look at other ways to try to handle that problem. But the second way that college admissions is broken is that while SATs and transcripts are predictive, they're not perfect. So they, too, miss potential. Lots of things intervene in life, and someone might have a blemish on the transcript. Parents get divorced. People learn in different ways. They question their sexual identity. Mom's in prison. Lots of things you have no control over can affect your transcript. And so while transcripts are predictive, they're not perfect. They miss things. And so we wanted to say, is there another way? Again, it's optional. It's not required. It's a second option for people where we might, you know, go back in, you know, so we've gone through the first time and we've picked off all the ripe fruit. Can we go back a second time and look for other things? And so that was the impetus to doing this, is to looking for a second chance, another way to go through and cull through the data, but also to encourage more students to apply to college who currently don't apply to college. I think that's a national imperative. We are leaving talent on the table, and as a country, we need to mine better and get more people with potential going to college.
Scott, let me turn to you on this. You've seen lots of campuses do, you know, tinker effectively, some cases in big ways and some cases in small ways, with various aspects of the admissions process. Students have submitted videos to supplement sort of traditional application materials for years. What to me is striking about what Goucher has done, in this case, it's not the video as a supplement, but as a video to supplant all the traditional paper documentation. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that is what makes it unusual. Going test optional, as Goucher did some years ago, has become quite common. The transcript, though, a lot of people are very hesitant about, and when I talked to folks and when I saw the comments that came into our site about this initiative, a lot of people think the transcript is pretty vital, that one of the big goals for higher education these days should be to tell high school students to take rigorous courses, to take them seriously, and the transcript is sort of your accountability measure there. And so there does seem to be, I'd say, a lot of some, not about asking them to do something creative in the video, but about not saying the transcript always matters, even with its flaws.
So, say, the materials that Goucher has released to date about the new video application alternative make it very clear that production values won't matter. You know, what we really, it doesn't have to be video in the sense of moving. It could be voiceover images. How do you score this? You know, if we were sitting in your office a couple months from now and you were showing us some samples, what's the score sheet look like that your admissions people will use in reviewing these videos?
Thanks. So if I could return just to Scott's point for 1 minute, which is that, you know, he has a point, and the transcript is predictive in lots of ways, and it does show a lot of things. And so you can submit your transcript. But, you know, if your high school has no APs, you can't take an AP course. Your high school didn't offer them. And so if you believe, wrongly perhaps, well, wrongly certainly, that you can't apply to college because your transcript has no AP courses, you just simply may not apply. So this is a way to get you to apply. And once I have that conversation started, you've submitted your video, you've been able to explain yourself. I can now say, well, you know, I need to see your transcript to get you financial aid, or I need you to come to campus for an interview, et cetera. So it's a conversation starter and a way to get maybe to the transcript. But we also find, you know, we interviewed a lot of students who said, you know, I had a good transcript, but I had one C in algebra freshman year, and I thought that, you know, disqualified me. Or I was embarrassed about this, you know, my sophomore year slump and my parents got divorced. So, you know, those, we wanted a way to have a conversation with those kids and perhaps get the transcript later, but not require it up front, because that's like going to the doctor. If I say, hey, you're going to come in for a shot, you don't go to the doctor. But I say, just come to the doctor. And they said, you know, you really need this shot. But now I got you in my office, I might be able to give you the shot. And so it's a little bit of that. So you asked me about the rubric. So we've put the rubric online. Part of this was being transparent. We want to model best higher education practice, best pedagogy. We know that teachers are score more fairly, and students produce better work when there's a rubric. So the rubric for this, exactly as you say, there's no points for production value. There are three areas, and again, this is visible on our website. The first is content. Did you think about what you wanted to say? Is there something interesting that you have to say? Not just, oh, my parents work at a college, and I want to go to college. The second is structure. Did you think about the sequence that you presented your ideas in? And the last is, was it an effective structure for the content? You know, did the form and the function go together? Were you convincing? Were you able to make your point effectively? And so we're putting it out there. Those are the three things students should think about when they tell us why they want to come to Goucher College.
So, Scott, you've been monitoring some of the comments posted at Inside Higher Ed when the story broke yesterday. A lot of people have said, yeah, looks, this is really interesting, but as you've scanned those comments ahead of our program today, what were some of the biggest buts as others were looking at what Goucher is doing?
A lot of them very much relate, again, to the transcript. So, for instance, it's definitely true. I think most college educators and high school educators would say that there's a lot of great talent out there that has a blemish or two or three on their high school transcript. But, for instance, a lot of college people tell me that they look at the pattern of grades. Was somebody maybe a little slow to mature and started off low, but the grades are getting stronger over the course of high school? That's a good indicator to maybe not focus on the overall GPA, but to focus on the junior year GPA. So, on the other hand, the opposite may be a sign for real concern. So, certainly at the super elite levels where people are saying that these days with the 5.0 GPAs for honors courses and AP that anything below a 4.9 is terrible. Well, that's a foolish way that excludes a lot of good students. But thoughtful reviewers of transcripts say they can tell a lot even about students who have had difficulties.
Jose, I want to come back to something you said earlier, and it is explaining the scoring, and that is the public presentation, at least as I read it yesterday, was here is an alternative path. Send us two papers, statement of academic integrity, and a two-minute video. You don't have to do transcripts. You don't have to do test scores. And yet, if I heard you correctly a few minutes ago, you seem to suggest or leave open for inference that may just be a first step and that the college may yet ask for a transcript for some students after they get the video. Is that correct?
Only for financial aid. Look, we're being very transparent. That we will admit students based upon this process, period. But if you want need-based aid, you're still going to have to do a FAFSA. You're going to have to tell us who your parents are. You know, there are other things we are required to get. If you want financial aid for merit, you might have to do something else. So we have one program where you have to write an essay and come for an interview. We might have another program where you say, well, you know, if you want to be considered for this scholarship, send us a transcript. So, yeah. But I'm going to go back to, you know, Scott's point is a very well-taken one, and he's absolutely right. Experienced admissions counselors can tell a lot from a transcript. But listen to those words, right? You know, we live in this world, so we forget how complicated college is and how mysterious it is, right? Rebecca Cox wrote a great book called College Fear Factor, where she sat through a group of, you know, freshman English classes for a year, Harvard University Press a few years ago, and she discovered that, you know, lots and lots of schools, lots of students, they actually make it to college, they pay their money, they get a parking sticker, they get to the parking lot on the first day of class, they throw up, and they go home. This is a terrifying place for people. So when you say, well, an experienced admissions counselor can decipher your transcript, and I've never been to college, and neither of my parents have been to college, I'm terrified. I don't know what that means. And that's assuming that I've even had that conversation with you. All I know about college is what I see on TV. Maybe I've heard of University of Florida because they have a football team. But that's what I know about college. I know it's this crazy, faraway place, and these people in suits are going to judge me based upon these letters and the marks next to them. So I might be able to have a conversation with a student and explain that, well, you know, we're going to look at your transcript this way, and if your grades are going up, that's better than if your grades are going down. And you know, we do that. Our college admissions counselors, not just at Goucher, but at every place, they do that. When they go to college fairs, they have those discussions. You know, I have a niece. I couldn't get my niece to go to a college fair. I talk to my brother. I say, have her go to a college fair. Oh, no, she's too scared. So she never got that information, and he went to college. But you know, his daughter never got that information about that blemish on the transcript, your grades are going up or whatever, you can do that. And so, you know, having that conversation, but I just think that those words that, you know, that Scott uttered, why they make perfect sense to us, and they're true, you know, that is a symbol of how highly complicated and mysterious it looks. Oh, well, there's something that happens in the back room of admissions where they look at your transcript this way and then they discover that. And I think that's a hard thing to explain to people, and I don't think they get it.
Scott, you summarized some of the critiques. Let me give you a chance to summarize some of the other comments in terms of what people liked about the Goucher Initiative.
Sure. The praise that I heard, and it relates to what Jose was just talking about, is that so many colleges these days, when they talk about admissions, are boasting about how many students they reject. And boasting about, you know, to be, you know, you have to have X average, X SAT, ACT scores, and whatever. And they look good, and they get good ratings for that, or they go up in the U.S. News and World Report rankings for that. And what I heard that people were encouraged by with the Goucher thing is, here is a college saying, you know, we want you to apply. And now how it works, I think, you know, we're going to have to come back to this a year from now and see what kind of students Goucher got. And then we actually really need to come back to this 4 years from now and see how they fared in college. But the positives that I heard was people so happy to hear college not talking about its rejection rate.
Well, and Jose, to that end, Scott's question about what does it look like a year from now for your class of 2015, what are the metrics of success for the video application policy? And let me frame this a little bit. By way of background, there's public information that suggests that last year Goucher admitted almost three-quarters of the applicants, and 16% actually showed up on the first day of classes. The conversation about reaching out to exceptional students who might be intimidated by the conventional admissions process aside, how many additional applications and enrolled students do you and your admissions people expect to have on campus as a result of this initiative for fall 2015?
So I don't know how many more applications we'll get, but that's not the point. I do think we'll get a few more applications, but I think yield will go up, and that is part of the point. You know, yield has gone down for most colleges because with the Common App, I mean, the good news is students can apply to more colleges more easily. The bad news is they check a couple of boxes. They've now applied to more colleges, and that makes it harder for colleges to know who has a real interest in them. So we wanted a way to actually be talking to students who had some interest in Goucher, just hadn't ticked a box, who were interested in what was unique about what we had to offer. So the metrics for us are going to be increased yield, increased diversity, in every way, and I actually think SAT scores will go up because I do think we're going to get more students interested in learning it. Well, what is it that's different about a liberal arts education? And to me, that's where the conversation really needs to go. I think part of what's happened in the public is that the idea of a liberal arts education has been devalued in the public's eye at exactly the moment when its value has actually increased in every way. Because as knowledge has become, you know, more abundant on the internet and more easily accessible, the ability to discern what is key, to do critical thinking, to analyze, has become more important. So, you know, every student actually arrives on campus today in a different world than all of us remember, where we remember the knowledge scarce world, where arriving on a college campus meant libraries and books and more knowledge. And now every student arrives with more knowledge on their phone than in any campus library, which means that the sorting and the critical thinking is more important. The same is true when they graduate, that 20 years from now, they will probably have a job for which a major now doesn't exist. So I can't actually invent majors fast enough because the job that you'll have in 20 years doesn't yet exist, which means that learning how to learn, learning how to think, learning how to communicate, all of those things just became more important. And that's exactly what a liberal arts education offers. And so at Goucher, we don't care what your major is. And we want to encourage you to explore and to learn how to think. And so that's a complicated thing when everybody in the country is now looking for a professional degree or a business degree to say, well, I want to go to Goucher because they're going to really teach me how to think. So I want to have those conversations with more students about what their future is like and what a liberal arts education really means.
Great. Gentlemen, thank you very much for an engaging conversation. So to our audience, we thank you for joining us this week, and we also extend our thanks to the individuals who aided and informed our in conversations. Josipa Roska, sociologist from the University of Virginia, Jose Antonio Bowen, the president of Goucher College, and of course Scott Jasek, the co-founder and a co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. This Week in Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or downloadable podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. on the web. We are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.